Race matters.
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 I'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from unceded Gadigal land. This land has been in the hands of generations of Gadigal custodians for thousands of years before us, and it will continue to be long after us. It's a meeting place for sharing knowledge, stories, and song, and we're privileged to be part of that storytelling today and every day at FBI Radio. I pay my respect to Gadigal elders past and present. We're broadcasting from Redfern right now. It's the birthplace of black theatre in this country and a site for resistance and resilience for First Nations peoples. We honour this in all the work we do and carry this into today's conversation. My name is Sharika Halaludin and you're listening to Race Matters. This is a show that explores the complexities of race, culture, and identity. Here on FBI Radio 94.5 and heard across the community radio network and wherever you get your podcasts. On today's show, we're asking, how can we gather in non-hierarchical ways? Can art making form solidarities? Can we create works that resist shallow representations of culture and work towards ways that form cultures of genuine reciprocity? Those are some pretty big questions, but are brought to the fore with a really exciting episode we have for you today in collaboration with Arts House down in Nam, Victoria. Caste is a hereditary and extremely violent form of social stratification. It's connected to labor, class, spirituality, and directly impacts access to land, education, basic civic and human rights. Dalit literally translates as broken but resilient. And it's a self-determined term for people deeply oppressed by the caste system. Dalit communities were and continue to be forced into bonded agricultural labor in India and the broader subcontinent, manual scavenging, and other inhumane forms of slavery. Alongside South Asia's Adivasi communities, indigenous communities, caste-oppressed peoples face discrimination, violence, and erasure at every structural level of society. Now, this isn't something that exists just in India and the subcontinent. It extends well into the diaspora of South Asia. Many of us are complicit in this system of oppression and violence, sometimes without even knowing. And in today's episode, we hope to unravel the complexities of what all of this means, but do that through creative and imaginative conversations. Today, you're going to hear a long and sprawling chat I had with curator Vishal and artists Elia Salavi and Jagat Dirasekara, and the possibilities of moving towards artistic and communal practices rooted in reciprocity and moving towards equity.
Thinking about how do you create non-hierarchical surfaces for gathering, and that is at the root of anti-caste thinking. Also on the abolition of social hierarchies, particularly social hierarchies that are based off of sort of illogical mythofictions.
So many queer bodies lifted these similar alarms and participated in these ceremonies for centuries. But we never recognized, we never mentioned, we always denied or ignored.
In one of those conversations, one woman told me, even the war has ended now, the sounds of the war are echoing in my ears. And then what she said started echoing in my ears. That was her memory. And personal memory as well as the collective memory.
Odalala translates from the depths of one's being. It's an art show that upends the colonial building of the Arts House space during Dalit History Month. It brings together local artists and international artists to examine histories of caste, migration, gender, and sexuality through contemporary expressions of art. This has all been envisioned by Dalit curator and artist Vishal Kumarasamy. Together with a whole cohort of artists, they shape-shift the building to defy conventional expectations that we expect of an art space through an anti-caste politics of curation.
So when I kind of got the invitation from Arts House, I was really interested in thinking about, I guess, like, what are the possibilities for the space, a kind of space with, like, really complex presence in Australia today and kind of contested ownership, right? Because not only is it on stolen land, it's also a very clear symbol of a time that resulted in the land being stolen. Thinking about how do you create non-hierarchical surfaces for gathering, and that is at the root of anti-caste thinking, is that anti-caste thinking is focused dominantly on the, well, in Babasaheb's words, annihilation of caste, but also on the abolition of social hierarchies, particularly social hierarchies that are based off of sort of illogical mythofictions. Thinking through caste as a structure that has parallels to structures of colony, structures of capitalism, but also structures of institutional sort of bureaucracy, institutional functioning, all of which essentially, not only do they reproduce hierarchies, but they also really enhance and exaggerate the experience of living through any sort of hierarchical model. So coming into Okuta, it was very much a process of like, how do we make sure that not only are the people, the human beings involved in the show, understand what it means to be anti-caste, but like, how do you really take an inflexible structure, like a building, like an institution, and really make it bend? And not bend in submission, as is the case with social hierarchy, but really bend in order to meet artists and meet sort of creative workers and cultural workers on a plane that is somewhat at least veering towards equity. Of course, given the institution is an institution, it's not always apparent or possible, but that was kind of how I was trying to really bring in thinking about anti-caste ways of organizing.
You're creating this plane of collaboration and creating, and even by calling it a gathering, you're kind of beginning to flip that top-down logic of curation. What are some of the considerations and challenges that come up when doing that?
For me, the audiences primarily was communities like mine, who are subaltern across different contexts. They're not always only marginalized caste populations, but they are made subaltern either due to different personal choices or due to those very same social hierarchies. So it's very much kind of thinking through what is the level of education around caste, and knowing very well that the large majority of South Asian population who should be and rightfully are, fully complicit in the system, do not have the kind of education that is required, a basic level of understanding, a basic level of caste consciousness. So the challenge was very much also starting at a point where the labor does not once again fall upon marginalized bodies to do that, or marginalized minds to do that. Instead, we start at a point where we are not contesting the fact that the social hierarchy exists. It's very much a statement, and we're moving forward from that. So whatever questions audiences or whoever might have, that is an invitation for them to embark upon that journey for themselves. So the challenge was very much resisting the urge to explain what is the system that we're fighting against. And that I found that was the problem in talking about colonization and decolonization and all these other structures or other frameworks of thinking. So even in kind of trying to embed it within the politics of the institution, we're also still contending with the fact that, you know, it is a settler colonial context. So within a settler colonial context, there's several degrees of separation between realities for different communities versus what institutional policymaking might see, or versus what curatorial frameworks might think of. And to really kind of set aside, I guess, the role of the curator as some sort of a hierarchical position, and serve more as a conduit between the institution and the artist, but primarily prioritizing the artist and not the institution. Because the institution is built to take care of itself, whereas artist practices and creative practices are not. So I guess the challenge has been about also finding a balance between that, and also finding space for pausing labor when it gets extreme on either of those ends.
Remember when we first met, you mentioned that you prefer to work in a way where you establish relationships before setting out with like a commission or a prompt with an artist. Are there any kind of active care protocols you have when you start to put forward this anti-caste, decentralized way of curating?
After a certain point, when I don't share, I guess, South Asian commonality between myself and the artists, we find other ways of establishing common ground, where we're really kind of thinking through culturally what are the shared references. And they might not always appear within the context of the framework of caste or the context of other social hierarchies. But the care extended by an artist towards their own practice definitely has those kind of similarities and mirrors the care that we understand within communities. So that for me has been the way to, I guess, make a gesture towards what that protocol might be. I found that also explicitly stating care as something that is exceptional is inherently problematic for me, because that means that there is a world in which it is optional, and that it can never be optional. It obviously, there is a boundary we need to draw between the amount of labor we can provide and the amount of labor we're able to, and also where we need to kind of say, well, actually, right now, I'm just not in that place to be able to do this. But it also does require, I think for me, it's also like the protocols that are changing for me is seeking and asking for reciprocity at the beginning, at the outset, which has been a learning process, because, you know, as a curator, you in the position of the curator, you're often put in commonly understood connotations of having some sort of outsized influence. You have a lot of power because that is the nature of curation elsewhere. But in trying to meet artists on somewhat of a shared common ground, I think for me, the difficulty has been seeking and requesting reciprocity and saying that actually we're kind of in this together. Because at the end of the day, like, I'm not really answerable to the institution as much as I am answerable to the artists.
The first thing was like to get to know each other. And I think those many conversations helped me to understand what vision Vishal has for this new exhibition. Sometimes, like for projects, there's like you have like an hour conversation, and then you need to get to something. So that was really beautiful to be able to share and talk about different ideas. One of the ideas which was talking a lot about my experience as a person from Afghanistan, lived in Iran, had so much challenges, so much questions from young age about my sexuality, and living and grew up in a quite religious family and religious society, and attending ceremonies, so many religious ceremonies, and how I describe how I saw myself in part of those ceremonies. I found it a little bit challenging to find a like-minded and how to not be that tokenistic artist of, you know, from South Asia or from Muslim background and being part of this exhibition. I made a work about this ceremony around Ashura and Muharram, and Vishal shared his own experience of growing up in India, where Shia community was also in the same suburb, and the finding that similar experience, you know, make it much more comfortable and make it much more close to the work as well. You don't need to explain every detail of those ceremonies or why you think that the small part is so important.
In my younger days, I put my life on courses, certain courses, and for the societal courses. So that informed me. And then when I do whatever I do in my life, I always think those who have given up their lives, that I will not, and I did not, knowingly or unknowingly, in the slightest way, did anything to damage or harm
Their dignity is my dignity. That's what informed me. Yeah, it is unshakable, unbreakable. I have built a very thick wall around me, which I will defend it to my life, sort of with my life, rather. I will not let anyone break it. So there were many occasions I have said that no, I'm not ready to produce that kind of work. And I have never produced any work outside of my art journals. When something comes to my mind, it is a conversation I'm having with myself. The two works that have been exhibited at Odalala, I Exist in Work. One was Seemingly Innocent. The other one was Not So White, Regained Territories. In fact, Vishal gave me full freedom to choose the work, showing those two works together.
I've heard you talk about presence and absence in your work, Elias, which I feel like is maybe an interesting way to think about queering as well. You know, we look towards these memories and rituals, and it could be assumed that we're not there, but in fact we have been shaping culture for millennia as kind of queer bodies of faith. Can we hear more about your work at Arts House, maybe thinking through these ideas of presence and absence and dislocation that you've begun to talk about?
Once you enter this space, you will see this 6.5 meters long a sculpture piece and more than 3 meters height. And it's an installation which filled with many still made elements in shapes of animals, in shapes of birds, figures like lion or flying horseman and dragon and also a tree shape, which is a symbol to cypress tree, and then on the top there are feathers, colorful feathers. So it's very elegant. It has so much presence there. And what I did, instead of using the traditional ways of having those religious poetry at the bottom part of the installation, I did prints of my own drawings and those poetries I mentioned by myself and others. For me, it was like how a poet like Muhtasham Kashani is known as a religious poet, but not as a queer poet. And the same how so many queer bodies lifted this similar alams and participated in these ceremonies for centuries, more than 1500 years. But we never recognized, we never mentioned, we always denied or ignored. So yeah, so the whole thing was like how we were there, and how we made changes, like especially those poets who contributed a lot in this kind of ceremonies, and how we localize as well. So although this is a religious ceremony unique to mostly to Shia people, the Shia people are more than 200 million people. So the whole ceremony is honoring the death of Imam Hussein, who was the grandson of Muhammad the Prophet. But how each area is ceremonies and alams are different. So if you go to Afghanistan, where I grew up in a very rural area in Daikundi, those ceremonies are quite different. Then you go to Mashhad, where I lived in Iran for a long time. The ceremonies, there are similarities, but also quite different. As someone who was born in Afghanistan and lived in Iran for a long time and then come to Australia and is still have many family members in those countries, especially in Iran and Afghanistan. I feel like I'm always living in between a few geographical places. I'm someone who's embraced that. So I find I've been very privileged being here. I mean, so-called Australia, but knowing how it separated me from many loved ones and many memories, and all of those thoughts informed my art practice as well. So my work talks a lot about memory, a lot about displacement, and also about queer identity, which I've been making number of artworks about my queer identity, but I didn't share it publicly until very recently. So the last two exhibitions I had, I've been starting talking more publicly about this, and I think through art and through the way I'm trying to slowly process this, how to talk about this publicly as well. So this project is very it's very important for me in many ways, and including I feel comfortable to talk both about my memories, which are associated with attending and witnessing religious ceremonies, and also my queer identity, and how I feel like I'm trying to think how I could have both, you know, with and how through this research, one of the main poems used in these religious ceremonies during the month of Muharram is by a poet who was born 500 years ago in today's Iran, and he's known as he's like he has the he wrote the best amazing religious poetry, but at the same time the same poet has censored poems which very openly he talks about his sexuality, but those poems are not known. So within this project I wanted to show some of those censored poems by him and others, and also my own poetry.
I'm gonna stay with this idea of, the dislocation of bodies, of culture, and turn back to you, Jagath. I feel like this is a theme that comes up in your work, particularly around, memory and like loss as well. From your kind of cultural and political context, what is it to bear witness as an act of resistance?
So when we are doing something which someone doesn't like, it is a resistance. For example, Sri Lankan state is trying to erase a particular memory. So it is our responsibility to keep it going. That's a personal responsibility as well as a societal responsibility. The work I mentioned, Seemingly Innocent, is a result of a long survey. Actually, it's more than 20 years of survey. I was mapping torture chambers of southern Sri Lanka. When I say southern Sri Lanka, other than north and east, Sri Lankan government decentralized torture chambers across the island between 1987 and 1990. I was part of the struggle, and I have experienced the acts as well. Once I returned, from that moment onwards, I started talking to friends. So I was keeping notes, mapping. It was not my intention that I would make an artwork out of it or something. I just was document for the sake of documenting to keep the memory going. Because these torture chambers were civil infrastructure, civil architectures.
So most of them have gone back to their original purpose now. At that point, military acquired them and converted to interrogation places or facilities or units or torture chambers. When I'm doing it, even though not individually, I'm honoring 60,000 men, women, and children who lost in that struggle. So Sri Lankan state killed 60,000 people within 3 years, according to European Parliament. And the other work, Not So White Regained Territories, is about how Sri Lankan state waged war in Tamil homeland. The Sri Lankan state launched their final onslaught on Tamil resistance in 2009. So they call it, we ended the war. During the last onslaught, some people were trying to cross. Sri Lankan government asked people to cross to the other side, right? Not from the rebel-held area. So some people came with white flags, and they were gunned down, right? They were gunned down. The Southern society, the single society where I come from, was boasting, we regained the territory, right? So that was the whole idea behind that work. And United Nations Special Rapporteur said, during the final onslaught, over 100,000 people became unaccounted for. So that's the context. And again, that is, I try to keep that memory in me about that going on. I had the opportunity to talk to people. And in one of those conversations, one woman told me, even the war has ended now, the sounds of the war are echoing in my ears. And then what she said started echoing my ears when I came here. So that was a memory, and personal memory as well as the collective memory.
Still on this idea of displacement, it almost feels like a necessary part of you being able to do this 2-year project. By being outside of the subcontinent, you can almost hold like a critical mirror back at it. I'm wondering if this resonates at all with you. I guess in short, why does Ukuta and Odalala have a home in Melbourne opposed to anywhere else?
Institutions are made up of individuals, and individuals are making political choices every day within these institutions. So the reason that I'm even in Melbourne on this guest curatorial project for 2 years is because of a political choice an individual made within that institution, which is Nitya. And it's important to recognize that and highlight that, because that is a divergent choice, right? It's not a choice of assimilating into an institution, but clearly marking a boundary, saying that this is kind of what the institution is demanding, but here is another way of maybe looking at it and getting the institution to reorient itself. Primarily, that is one of the main reasons. The other main reason is my own practice, which just does not really exist in India as a political choice, because we don't have institutions or infrastructures that have caste consciousness coming into contact with those institutions, with those infrastructures, is to repeatedly face acts of violence. It's not that that violence is not present elsewhere. It's that it's once again kind of going back to what Elias and Jagat were saying, and also how we started, like, I guess for me, how I started thinking about how their practices would be in conversation was through that. Because I have to, for lack of a better term, embark upon periods of exile in order to make work. Because whether that's an exile from the infrastructures within the country, or within the context of South Asia, but also understanding that you're trying to make a willful, I guess like a really empowered choice to kind of present works in a context where you have the opportunity to start or to kind of change what the starting point of the conversation is. That is really, for me, why Okuta Odalala Nirikshane, all of them exist in Melbourne, because it's also asking South Asians and other communities here, saying that now that we are separate from sites of violence, which a lot of us have experienced in within our own bodies, within our own context, now that we are away and we are trying to build lives for ourselves and trying to build meaning for ourselves, is this not the right time to embark upon actually deepening understanding of the kind of systems that you're complicit in? And that is mostly geared towards South Asians as a community at large. Because the refrain often is that, or the kind of response often is that it's not possible to do it in South Asia. And then, so the question for me is like, so what's stopping people here? And it's the same thing. It's also an act of protecting myself from the violence, is to go out and say publicly in India that I'm a Dalit man trying to do these things where I'm essentially countering, challenging state narratives, challenging narratives of the social fabric of South Asia. Whether I'm not really doing it individually, but that also means that I'm going to have to place the bodies of the artists also at risk. Something that I'm not willing to do. I'm not willing to do that for myself, because I don't see why Dalit bodies particularly need to be at risk all the time in order to make a point. Whereas in the case of Melbourne, it's that I can retreat. I have the option, I have the choice of retreating from when the violence feels acute, or from when those kind of systemic factors come back into focus. And it does also provide opportunities for friction that isn't always violent. And this is where there is some space, as much as it is happening within the context of a settler colonial enterprise, there is space for nuance, because of the kind of political choices individuals have been making. So the space is not, you know, it's not just granted. It's been won, you know, with a lot of difficulty. So it's very much also not taking that space for granted, and really saying, now that we have this much space here, let us now try and invite people to be nuanced about how they're feeling about things, and also place accountability on their own engagement. Is that engagement, like, nowhere across the 2 years am I trying to explain caste to anybody? Am I trying to explain what the structures are? We are highlighting its specific instances. We're talking about specific lived experiences, but at no point does it become a didactic exercise, as is the case a lot of us may have experienced being artists ourselves in other kind of frameworks. And even for this, I think the kind of request, or like the need for artists' presence of their bodies, of their practices in the show, is not to always explain the background histories, because I think that is where we also draw the line at trying to say that, you know, if you really want to know more, you have to go to the artist. You have to go to the body that has the lived experience. I'm not going to produce a 10-page essay of why Alice's work and Jagat's work and my work or anybody's work in the show is important, because that is not the labor that we should be performing. That is the labor of the witness.
In re-centering, you know, what you're doing as like a Dalit curator and privileging the wisdom of lived experience, how can approaches like this move towards art making that's grounded in solidarity and move towards safety?
Cultural safety for one practice, one context, can result in violence elsewhere. And I think that is also important to acknowledge, that we have to find ways in which they are, we find a lot more kind of shared realities and shared experiences of realities. I found, particularly in the conversation around cultural safety, there is a tendency, at least within the diaspora, but also within South Asia, to constantly reiterate only exceptional acts of violence as deserving of cultural safety, and not always in the everyday things. A lot of what we understand as socio-cultural practices across the subcontinent actually have rooted origins in practices of different communities. But in the quest for deeming something as a culturally safe practice, those are not always the same vocabularies for me in the context of Australia, because I'm very much a kind of somewhat seasonal visitor here. Don't live here. I don't, for lack of a better term, have any skin in this kind of game of colonial enterprise here. Which also means that there is a projected kind of air of objectivity about my being and presence here, which I don't share. I do have subjective experiences being here. It's not that, you know, I'm a neutral party in any way. I'm very much complicit in other systems, whether even as I am trying to gesture towards systems that I have lived experience in, I'm still very much, you know, complicit within patriarchy, within capitalism, within colonial endeavors, just by virtue of being here. And I think that is, for me, a way to think about who gets to determine what is and isn't cultural safety, particularly in the context of things that are happening around the world right now. Least of all is the complete, lack of humanity that we're seeing. It's also something that I find difficult to kind of draw parallels to. And I think that comes from coming from a context where for centuries, the horrors occurring in our parts of the world were just invisible or were just written off into other narratives. We're seeing literally what is happening right now in Gaza, what happened in Afghanistan, what happened in Iraq, what happened in the Elam lands in 2009. And these are all like fresh memories for us, right? They're for a lot of us, it's whether we like it or not, they're going to become epigenetic memory. Whether we don't have a choice in that. It is what it is. That is exactly what we're going to end up dealing with. But for me, that is the thing. The bounds of what constitutes cultural safety is difficult to address, because then there isn't a one-size-fits-all approach. They can't be, and they shouldn't be. And for me, the cultural safety has to be really a personal exercise. People need to have enough information in order to exercise the choices they're making about how they engage with the kind of things we're talking about. The fact that people choose not to educate themselves is beyond our control. What I find is possible is to create moments where there are exchanges that can happen that aren't always about education, that aren't always only about friction or only about antagonistic kind of ways. And that is primarily because, just as being somebody who's coming from having had only one generation prior to me, access to education, access to kind of resources and facilities, the ways in which we learn and the ways in which we perform community, the ways in which we've understood cultural safety are not through any of the regulated systems, or not through any formal education systems, and not through any mechanisms that guarantee that somehow my rights are going to be protected. Those things were hard won. Like, guaranteeing your own cultural safety is very much trying to resist either assimilation, resist violence, resist erasure. And for me, I see the task, at least within the role of the curator, within the role of the exhibition, within the role of this project over the 2 years, is to kind of highlight the fact that this resistance is ongoing. And when you come in to engage with the works, it's not separate. At no point is it different to what each of us are already practicing. And so for me, some of the conversations that are happening here that I'm witnessing around cultural safety has this very strange disembodied way of thinking about it, which is just not possible. At least for me, in the framework of the project and the exhibition, I've hoped, and I hope it has come across, is that people are not able to separate those two things. They're not able to separate the fact that a work is a political statement, the person is a political person. Those are not things that we wake up mornings and say that, oh, today I'm going to be political and tomorrow I'm not, right? So why do we also not, for me, the kind of, I guess, that political action within the exhibition is very much to state that there isn't an option to kind of separate the two. And there shouldn't be. There shouldn't be an option to kind of encounter Elias or Jagat's work, any of the artist's work, and separate it from the context and aestheticize the objects, aestheticize the work as merely kind of simulacra of things. But actually, that is just not possible, because the faith produces the object. If there is no faith, there is no object. The lived experience produces Jagat's work. If the lived experience wasn't there, that is not the form of the work that we would see. And that's how I saw it. And that's how I was trying to bring in the connection. Say, having a broader understanding of maybe different cultures within the project might gesture towards people saying, oh, this is a, you know, we have to be careful about how we tread, without placing the explicit demand of like, oh, be careful when you're walking around here, which is kind of, I don't know if those two things make sense, but that's kind of how I see cultural safety. Also putting the agency back and really emphasizing autonomy of audiences and viewers, and not trying to make an authoritative or autocratic demand for it. I think maybe the hope is to understand that it's not always possible to use the same language everywhere, especially when it comes to even the language of existence, the language of politics, and the language of safety, or of inclusion, or of breaking down social hierarchies. We're kind of communicating to everybody that there might be, you know, debris falling. We know that the work is underway. In no means to say that, you know, the exhibition is any sort of complete kind of example of what any of that looked like, but very much that the project is demonstrating the work that is being done.
That is all for Race Matters this week. My name is Sharika Helaludin. You've been listening to a special episode made in collaboration with Arts House down in Nam, Victoria. For Dalit History Month, that was Odalala Dispatches, dialogues from the anti-caste, imaginative and expansive output curated by Vishal Kumarasamy, who I was in conversation with, alongside two of the show's artists, Elias Salavi and Jagat Dirasekara. To learn more about the show and the consciousness and efforts behind it, we've left some details in our show notes. A special shout out to those who helped this episode come together across these borders. Vishal Kumarasamy himself, for deepening the connection between these artists and Race Matters. Luana Sainsbury, Varsha Ramesh, and a special shout out to Nithya Nagarajan, who dreamt up this curation alongside Vishal, and for putting forward the connection between radical broadcasting like Race Matters and the output of an exhibition like Odalala. If you want to listen back to any episodes of Race Matters, you can head to fbiradio.com/racematters. You can listen to us nationally across the Community Radio Network and wherever you get your podcasts.
Race Matters. Race Matters.
Race Matters.
Race Matters.
Race Matters.
Race Matters.